From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien. Welcome to Speakers Forum, a series of talks and interviews with writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. This podcast version features prose readings from the third annual Lit Crawl Seattle, an event inspired by Litquake, San Francisco's literary festival. Seattle's version is a one-night-only mashup of literary festival and pub crawl. Over 60 authors do their best to silence you or rile you up as you make your way from space to space. Lit Crawl Seattle is a volunteer organization. Readers, hosts, venues, and sponsors donate time, goods, and services to make it possible. This year's sponsors include the Elliott Bay Book Company, Georgetown Brewing Company, Hugo House, Shunpike, Four Culture, and DCG One. The third annual Lit Crawl Seattle took place on October 23, 2014, at venues around Capitol Hill. Thanks to Michelle Goodman and Anna Tatashev for these recordings. Next up in our Seattle Lit Crawl tag-along, you'll hear from the host of the Hugo House 7 at 7 event, writer Jenny Shortridge. Please be advised, the following program contains language of an adult nature.
Seattle Seven Writers is a collective of Seattle authors. We're up to about 70-some-odd. I don't even know anymore. We do good works in the community for literacy, and we try to promote Northwest literature. We always say, read local, because there's so many good authors and books here, and that's all I'm going to say about Seattle Seven, and that's it. We have seven writers, so we're going to get right to it, and I am number one. And I'm, woohoo! My name is Jenny Shortridge, and I'm going to introduce myself, because, you know, why not? Everyone else gets an introduction. So, I am the co-founder, along with Garth Stein, of Seattle Seven Writers, a nonprofit collective of authors. And I published 5 novels, including Love, Water, Memory, which may or may not be made into a Showtime miniseries very soon. And would like to read something really different for me tonight. It's an essay called When a Mind Breaks. Keeping with our theme tonight, I've decided to retitle it Seven. For absolutely no reason other than I couldn't think of anything else that had to do with Seven. Although you'll hear a couple. A few weeks before my 57-year-old mother died in early 2000, she admitted to me something I'd long suspected. When I was 2 years old, my mom was 27, with 4 children aged 7 and under. I've already said 3 sevens, just so you know. She'd moved away from her family on the East Coast to North Dakota. The snow outside was 2 feet high. She'd already had a nervous breakdown at 19, and the weight of everything now was too much. With my 2 older sisters at school and the baby and me at home, a feeling overtook her, an idea, a thought. I don't know. I can never know what it felt like to be her. But she suddenly realized she was in danger of harming my sister and me, of following her mind's broken impulse to kill us. I also don't know what she did that day before she locked herself in her bedroom and called my father to tell him that something was wrong. But this admission explained a lot. I'd known a deep sense of terror from my earliest memories, from before I could speak. I felt like a silent kind of screaming was in my head where no one could help me. I was afraid of everything as a little girl, flashbulbs, loud noises, intruders with knives in the night. But I never equated any of it with my mom, because if you have to be afraid of your own mother, how on earth will you survive? My mission as a child was to figure out my mother's brain, what made her happy and loving on some days, and what made her withdraw or become mean. What made her vacuum at 2 in the morning, then sleep until well after we arrived home from school the next day? What made her want to terrify us with suicide attempts or acts of violence against us? What made her disappear for weeks at a time, then arrive home from the hospital empty-eyed, a stranger? I poured every ounce of energy I had during the bad times into keeping my mother alive, somehow, by being invisible, by being a good girl, if that would help, by entertaining her, if that was necessary. I was like the kid at the circus, keeping the tightrope walker on the wire with sheer force of will. When my mom felt truly awful, she seemed to need the comfort of sharing her burden with us. She spared us very little of her pain and told us we would be just like her someday. As I grew older, I felt defiant about this, saying, no f***ing way will I ever be like her. But of course, there was a part of me deep inside that believed I would. that believed my mother's disease was just lying in wait to attack me at some particular life stage, whether it be puberty, motherhood, menopause. She warned us about so many of life's transitions and the horror they would bring. My first full-blown panic attack hit me at age 14 on my first date, out for dinner at a very adult restaurant. Earlier in the day, Mike had cut his finger quite badly in the kitchen, and his parents just wrapped it up mummy style in gauze. Fresh blood kept soaking through each new layer. As I tried to determine which piece of flatware to use and how to elegantly cut a steak, I broke out into a cold sweat. I thought I could overhear disco music coming from the lounge. It was the 70s. Then I realized it was the too fast thumping of my heart. My vision blurred. I couldn't breathe. I thought I was spooling out into my mother's universe, going crazy wherever that was. And I didn't know if I'd ever return. In retrospect, I know that I felt responsible for keeping him alive, as silly as that now sounds. I had to keep that tightrope walker in the air and maintain my composure in this formal environment. And having no idea how to do either, I panicked. I would battle panic attacks and free-floating anxiety for the next 10 years, always secretly certain that this time I would finally lose my mind once and for all. But no one knew any of this. I kept it to myself. I fought hard to look normal at all times. I never let on that anything was wrong, a skill that I'd learned from growing up. We never told anyone about my mom, and I never told anyone what I was going through either. By my early 20s, I'd mastered looking normal and had been supporting myself for several years. I had a mortgage and a live-in boyfriend. When he was diagnosed with cancer, I went into overdrive taking care of him. I could no longer sleep ever. I cried a lot. The panic was always clutching my throat, making it difficult to even get enough oxygen. If only I wasn't this way. If only I hadn't had a crazy mom. If only I really was normal. My boss took note of my condition when I asked for a sick day to catch up on sleep. He was not kind about it either, telling me I was weak for not being able to handle my boyfriend's cancer better. A coworker overheard and gave me the name of a mental health counselor. I cried through my first several months of therapy, and over time, I got better. And when I say time, I mean 7 years, every week, rain or shine. It took a long time to understand that my mom was very ill, not trying to be crazy or mean or frightening, and that my brain had hardwired in panic mode, a condition we now understand as post-traumatic stress disorder, a response that makes perfect sense. Because my mother had also become a prescription drug addict, I refused medication until my early 40s. I have now taken a daily anti-anxiety pill for over 10 years. I thought I was being strong by not taking medication, but I was only prolonging the pain. Sure, I was able to survive without it, but I've lived a much more satisfying and emotionally rich life. I've had a lot of time to figure things out now, that I'm nearing the age my mother lived to be. That she shut herself down in the midst of psychosis and homicidal ideations toward her children is one of the most courageous and actual death-defying acts of motherhood imaginable. Many mothers with mental illness have not been able to fight those demons, and we read about them in the paper and think, how on earth could she kill her children? But mental illness doesn't reason with its victims or listen to their pleas for normalcy, just as cancer doesn't. The head, the brain, is as much a part of the body as a pancreas is, or a heart. And when afflicted by horrible illness, it fails. I wish there had been better mental health care in the 60s and 70s. And I wish there was now. I wish there was still not a stigma around mental illness, and that people talked about it more openly, so that we could all learn from each other. But mostly when it comes to my mom, I wish there was a way to let her know how brave and strong she was that long ago snowy day when her mind broke and she walked away from us and closed the door. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks. We have a treat in store. Next, we have Donna Mascolta, whose first novel was When the De La Cruz Family Danced, which was published in June 2011. Her story collection, Natalie Wood's Fake Puerto Rican Accent, was a finalist for the 2010 Grace Paley Prize for Short Fiction. Her work has appeared in many journals and reviews, and she has received numerous grants, awards, and residencies. She's an ardent supporter and contributor to Seattle's literary community, and we are so delighted to have her here tonight. So please join me in welcoming Donna Mascolta.
Thank you, Jenny. Can you hear me? Okay. This is a short excerpt from a novel I'm working on called The Education of Angie Rubio. Angie sprinted, slowed, veered left, then right, doubled back, the dust flying in her face, a pebble pinging off her glasses. After days of standing on the sidelines, she had joined the group, the small mob of sixth-grade girls in pursuit of Miles Jones, the boy with the English accent. How someone from Liverpool could find his way to Kimball Park was a miracle, one in a million, and no one should take it lightly. Certainly not this gang of girls, some of whom were already plotting to sneak Miles, a mere fourth grader, into the sixth grade dance on Saturday. Though now she was part of the mindless with Beatlemania chase, she refused to scream or swoon at the sight of Miles's floppy brown hair or the sound of his Paul McCartney lilt, despite Jory Page Schroeder. Jory Page Schroeder was the biggest screaming swooner of the pack. Her name was really Debbie, but she had somehow managed to get everyone to call her Jory Page, a name she had jigsawed together from the first two letters of the name of each of the Beatles. Jory Page Schroeder made Angie feel small, not just because she was small and skinny to boot, but because Jory Page used words as if they were baseball bats. Just yesterday in the girls' lavatory, Angie emerged from a stall, only to be confronted by Jory Page's blue eyes boring down on her. "Don't you like the Beatles?" "Yes, I love the Beatles." Angie had recently learned to gush by listening to Judy Wykamp and Sylvia Rico and the other girls who panted their words. Angie gave it another try. "I adore the Beatles." "Then why aren't you chasing after Miles like the rest of us?" Angie thought it best not to point out that Miles was not a Beatle. "I have asthma or something," she lied. Her cousin Eddie was afflicted with all sorts of maladies, and Angie often borrowed one when it was convenient. "I would sacrifice my life for something I believed in," Jory Page said, narrowing her blue eyes at Angie before flouncing past her into the stall and slamming shut the door. "But I think it might be under control soon, the asthma," Angie called through the door. "I have some medicine at home. I'll be fine tomorrow," she promised over the flush of the toilet. Now tomorrow was today, and she was in the chase. So she ran. And though a stitch in her side distorted her gait, and one of her shoelaces had worked itself loose, she kept on running. Until she realized she was running alone. There was just too much clutter with dodgeball and kickball games going on around her, and kids running in and out of the sandbox that held the monkey bars. She had lost the hunt, and now trotted back and forth, trying to locate the others. When she stopped a moment to get her bearings, a stray ball bounced into her back, making her stumble and dislodging her glasses. She was adjusting them when she heard Jory Page shout her name. Though she had her glasses on straight now, her vision was impaired by the cloud of dust kicked up by Miles as he shot past her, followed soon by the panting posse. Jory Page skidded to a stop in front of her, a scowl of incomprehension inflaming her face. "How could you just stand there and do nothing?" Then she was off, her rebuke trailing into a Beatlemania scream as she rejoined the chase. The stitch in Angie's side seemed to have moved to her throat. She swallowed hard and stooped to retie the wayward shoelace. She would get back in Jory Page's good graces, she vowed to herself. There was still lunch recess. Yesterday after school, Jory Page had reminded the posse that they were all to know the words to help. So Angie had gone home and played help on the record player over and over, closing her eyes, moving her lips to the words, fixing them in her head. But then Eva walked in. She was in junior high and wore a bra and black flats with nylon stockings and a touch of lipstick, all of which made her seem an imposter. As she sang along to help, Angie watched Eva take off her shoes and stockings and lipstick, watched her unmask herself, hoping to see the old Eva appear. "What are you staring at?" Eva snapped. Angie moved her gaze to the ceiling and kept singing. Eva turned off the record player. "When did you get so mean?" Angie asked. But she knew the answer, knew that it was the junior high costume, its poor fit, the feeling of being trapped in those stockings. Deprived of the record player, Angie talked the words to the song. "When I was younger, so much younger than today, I never needed anybody's help in any way." "Shut up, Angie," Eva said. "But now these days are gone. I'm not so self-assured." The words drove Eva from the room, and Angie sat alone to learn them by heart. Angie was good at memorizing, and now she was consoled by the prospect of redeeming herself with the posse at lunch recess. Having tied her shoe, she stood and looked around. If she stood where she was, she might blend into one of the games around here, appear to be an outfielder for kickball, or part of the ragged dodgeball circle. She stood there thinking, shouldn't the bell have rung by now? She squinted upward as if the answer was there in the sky, cloudless and blue, the sun beaming genially as if all life were fun and games. Just when orange spots were beginning to zip across her glasses, she heard the frantic shouts of her name, the command issuing from Jory Page and Judy Wykamp and Sylvia Rico and the others, "Grab him, Angie." She looked up and saw Miles running her way, his John Lennon hair flapping. A breeze filled his shirt so that its ballooning fabric offered a handhold, but when she reached for it, the airy shirt fluttered from her grasp. She made one last heroic lunge and was rewarded with a fistful of sleeve, which she clutched triumphantly. Miles, slight fourth grader that he was, still outmuscled her, and as he tried to continue his momentum, he pulled Angie after him. She staggered, fought for balance, finally gained both feet again, when he suddenly twisted sideways, away from the unyielding grip she had on his sleeve, and the rip that followed seemed to slice through all the noise of the playground, seemed to bring all the games to a halt. She was sure that everyone witnessed Miles staring at her, at the gap in his shirt, at the shred of fabric in her hand. He gaped in horror, as if she'd torn off his arm rather than his sleeve. She stared back, unable to speak. And then he ran off in tears to the teacher on playground duty. It was then that she understood that despite all shouts of "catch Miles," it was never the intention that anyone really catch him, much less touch him, much less tear the sleeve off his shirt. It was all about the chase, only the chase. Jory Page, glassy-eyed and open-mouthed, sleepwalked toward her. Angie held the sleeve helplessly in front of her, and she could see in Jory Page's crushed expression, now that the chase was over forever, how much she wanted to grab the sleeve in Angie's hand, but couldn't. Because even screaming, swooning Jory Page Schroeder knew better, knew the rules of the game. Thanks.
Fun, huh? Next up, we have Tara Conklin, who is the author of House Girl, I believe a New York Times bestseller. She's a writer and a lawyer and has worked as a litigator in the New York and London offices of corporate law firm. She now devotes herself full-time to writing fiction and raising some offspring, I believe. Prior to law school, Tara dealt cards at a casino in Costa Rica, planned events at a press center in Moscow, taught English at a school in Madrid, and waited tables at a hotel in Montana. Her short fiction has appeared in the Bristol Prize Anthology in Pangea, an anthology of stories from around the globe. I give you the very worldly Tara Conklin.
Gosh, it's bright up here. Okay, this is some new work. This is from my second novel, which, if all goes according to plan, will be published in February of 2016. It's called The Last Romantics. So here goes. The last and truest love affair of Joseph Patrick Skinner's too short life began on a limpid Miami afternoon when he went looking for a drink. He told his secretary, Gina, he had an appointment with his chiropractor, and he didn't know how long it would take. Maybe he'd be back, maybe he wouldn't. And then he headed toward the water. He walked with the goal of putting sufficient distance between his drinking and the office. It hadn't been a bad day, he just needed out. That grinding of teeth feeling, the sweat rising along his hairline and inside his shoes, the headachy drone of too much talking. Outside, everything wasn't excellent. The sidewalks heaved with people and a car with its stereo volume turned way up, sent its gut-thumping bass line straight into the space between Joe's eyebrows. But outside was definitely better. The Miami sky, the Miami sunshine. Some mornings he ached for New York in a way that before he'd associated only with sex, but today the blue air and groggy heat felt familiar. They felt nice. Joe slung his jacket over his shoulder and crisscrossed block after block until the stream of tourists thickened, seagulls circled overhead, and he tasted the saltwater tang. He'd been walking for about 20 minutes, safe, he thought, when he saw a discreet low-hanging sign, Revel, bar and restaurant. Joe stopped. He stepped down off the sidewalk and descended into the space. A long, darkly polished bar faced a half bank of windows that looked out towards the bay. Behind the bar, Joe glimpsed a vast restaurant area with glass-top tables, all empty at this hour. The place had the feel of a deep crevasse lit by a slash of sun glittering far above. Luna Hernandez had tended bar there on and off for 4 years, and on the day Joe walked in, was considering when and how she would leave. Recently, she'd noticed an encroaching sloppiness in her work. Where once she had poured with precision and flair, now she splashed and slouched. Every shift, her thoughts were occupied by the elements of motion, flying, sailing, running, torque and spin. The bar opened at 4 o'clock, and throughout the lengthening amber hours of sunset, she watched lycra-clad bodies careen along the boardwalk, and her own legs would ache with an urgent restlessness. On the afternoon she met Joe, Luna was thinking about money, how to get more of it, and how much she would need to fund her departure, to buy a plane ticket or a bus ticket or a car. But these evaluations required that she select an actual destination, which she didn't feel ready to do, not yet. And then the figure of a man appeared in her field of vision, a customer. He was already established on a bar stool, waiting for her to be ready for him. Luna stopped the relentless wheels that rolled around the edges of her future, and she looked up. "Gin and tonic, please, Gibson's," Joe said. His voice was tired. He had a pale little boy's face made puffy and gray by middle age or by something more insidious but reversible, like a long illness or habitual sadness. He was broad-shouldered, long-armed, dark brown hair curled at his forehead and around his ears, and his eyes were a deep, startling blue. Luna's first impression was of a recently departed handsomeness that carried with it the promise of an imminent return. It was this potential that made Luna smile, perhaps more broadly than she would have normally for a new customer, and lean across the bar and say, "Coming right up." She turned her back on him to make the drink, and she knew he was eyeing her up and down. She saw him in the mirror that hung behind the bar, and she knew that men looked at her like that. They always had. She took her time with cutting the lime, pouring the measure neat of gin. She placed a napkin on the bar first, then the drink. "Gibson's," she said. That night they got to talking. Joe had 5 gin and tonics and left her a $50 tip. Luna suspected he would be back, and so he was, the next night and the next. And the next. For nearly his entire adult life, Joe had considered himself successful with women. With 3 sisters, 1 mother, a dead father, he was the sole masculine witness to all the feminine happenings that swirled around him, the first periods, first bras, bad haircuts, bad dates. He was grateful for what his sisters had bestowed upon him. He knew how to talk to girls. He knew what they wanted to hear. But every so often, he had a sense of having missed something. The mystery of it all, the ineffable whiff of girl that to him was as common as sock rot, but would throw his high school friends into spasms of itchy joy. In college, he'd been cocky. No, he'd been an asshole. He'd felt so charmingly secure that he looked upon the roster of female students in the same way he surveyed the dining hall's Sunday brunch buffet. A wealth of available dishes laid out before him, and what today did he happen to fancy? And almost without exception, they fancied him right back. When had a woman said no to Joe Skinner? There had been that Smith psych major visiting her cousin, and a lifeguard down at Myrtle Beach who he was sure preferred girls anyhow. And that brief period of early adolescence when he'd slouched around all acne-studded and skinny. At 13, he'd grown too tall too fast, and the rest of him took some time to catch up. But those episodes existed as only the barest blips in his near-perfect record of romantic achievement. Until the divorce. Until Lisa blindsided him. Divorce? The word had never entered his vocabulary. It felt awkward just to force out the syllables. They made him think of some slit-eyed broad with stocky legs and a bad dye job. Divorce? Not Lisa, his Lisa. His princess with a tiny waist and precisely applied blonde highlights and dainty feet. She fit into those crazy mile-high heels that click all over the bare wood floors of their apartment. His Lisa would never want a divorce until she did. And Joe found himself questioning the fundamentals in a way he hadn't since he'd been that stooping, red-cheeked 13-year-old facing himself in the mirror. Am I attractive? Will I be strong? Who will love me? Luna Hernandez. That's what her name was. Luna the bartender. Luna like the moon, like a lunatic, like you're driving me insane. Did he need to ask Luna out? Joe studied his phone to avoid watching her. She was pouring a glass of red for a man in a tight t-shirt and jeans. I know his boyfriend, Luna informed Joe as she cleared his empty glass. The knobby bone on her tan wrist spun on the axis of her arm as she poured him another. Joe inhaled. I'm sure you get this a lot, he began, but maybe you should have dinner with me. It was 9 p.m. on a Friday, and the bar was busy and loud. What? Luna replied, though she had heard him. Have dinner with me, Joe yelled, cupping his hands around his mouth. Please. She liked the humor of this tall man and his little please, the brave smile as though she had already said no. She put down the bottle of gin and waited a few seconds, trying to decide if she should have fun with him. And then she stepped forward and rested her hands on the bar. Her fingers were inches from his sweating glass, the beads of water heavy along its sides. Yes, she said. That's it.
Hot stuff, eh? Okay, so before his umpteen thrillers, I've lost count, I can't tell you how many, landed him on the New York Times bestseller list, Kevin O'Brien was a railroad inspector who worked all the livelong day and wrote novels at night. He grew up on Chicago's North Shore, the youngest of six children, and studied journalism at Marquette University. He moved to Seattle in 1980, and his railroad job took him all over the Pacific Northwest. He wrote most of his first novel in Best Westerns and Red Lions. Now he writes all night and sleeps all day. His latest book is just out, and it's called Tell Me You're Sorry.
I'm sorry, I'm sorry.
Ladies and gents, Kevin O'Brien.
I am going to take such a half gainer double twist down these. There's some stairs here. This is like, oh, my God, I can't see a thing except the spotlight. Am I neon, too? Okay, I have to be different from everybody else because I cannot talk. I cannot speak. I cannot read. Hello. I can't do anything. Help me. I can't read in front of an audience. It's like the King's Speech all over again. I told our fearless leader here, Jenny, that I would just come up and give seven places in Seattle where I've killed people. In my books. So I was going to say, get a show of hands to see how many people have read my books, but all I can see is like two people in the front row. Everybody else is in the, you're
all
the rest.
Hands up, Kevin.
I know. They all, okay, cool. That's what I like to hear. All right. Well, I'm going to go through the book list anyway, so because it's kind of amusing and it's part of my shtick. It's what I do. Anyway. my first thriller was called The Next to Die. I didn't name any of my books. My editor did it. And he just went through phases. So The Next to Die, Watch Them... No. The Next to Die, Make Them Cry, Watch Them Die. So I was like, should I do a cookbook called Eat a Pie? I don't know, a love connection book, Meet a Guy? And then he pulled a fast one on me, and he changed it to a Left 4 Dead was the next one. The last so that just came out of nowhere. And then he did one called The Last Victim, or I did one called The Last Victim, and that's what he named it. And then it was followed by things with last or final. So it was like one last scream, final breath, something else. I've lost track of all my titles. But then he suddenly pulled a fast one on me, and I was writing one, and I was wondering what he was going to call it, and he decided suddenly, let's call it Vicious. And I was like, what happened to the final? What happened to the... And so Vicious, when it came out, it was like Kevin, and they put Vicious right in the middle of it, and it's Kevin Vicious O'Brien. And it's like, and it looked like it was my middle name, you know, change it from David to Vicious. So this was followed by Kevin O'Brien Disturbed. Kevin O'Brien Terrified. Kevin O'Brien Unspeakable, which turned out to be my first book on audio. How ironic, Unspeakable. Anyway. This was followed by Tell Me You're Sorry, which actually is a big hit. I'm stunned. Anyway, yes, thank you. Thank you very much. Anyway, I am working on my new book, hence the bags under my eyes, and probably these glaring lights are showing that I'm like very tired. But it's called No One Needs to Know. I didn't. You know, so he's kind of going through these long sort of titles after the short ones and stuff like that. Who knows? Anyway, let's get to it. I probably used up my 7 minutes already. One of the first places I've killed people in Seattle is the Shannon. And I have a neighbor that's out here who lives in the Shannon. I bet you she didn't know. And watch them die. I killed a person. I threw her out the 8th floor window of the Shannon, which is that big, tall building on Mercer and Boylston. Is that what it is, Leo? Bellevue, thank you. And it's gorgeous. And there's like 3 big tall buildings. Her name was Cindy, the victim, named after my sister was having some issues with this woman in her office named Cindy. And she was like, and she was telling me Cindy stories all the time. And I said, would you like me to kill her for you? And she said, yes. So, and I said, can I make her a bitch too? And she said, yeah, she is a bitch. Kill her. So Cindy is, Watch Them Die was about a woman who works in a video store. God, talk about, you know, this was written a long time ago, a video store. And Cindy is one of her customers who comes in and sort of chews her out because she has a late fee. And she's lying, of course, because Cindy's a bitch. And so the next thing we know, she is shoplifting at the QFC. She butts in front of somebody at the Top Pot Donuts. And then she steals a neighbor's Sunday Times. She goes up to her room in her suite in the 8th floor of the Shannon, and some guy in a ski mask comes and lunges her, beats the crap out of her, and then throws her out the window, and she lands on top of Mercedes. So I think I took care of my sister's coworker pretty well. So that was one of the first places I've killed somebody. The Westin Hotel, I don't know if they have a gym or not, but I called it the West Hill Hotel and had a gym at the top. And it was so funny. And my sister-in-law was just visiting me, and she said, she's staying at the Olympic, I think, and she said, you know, it's a creepy place where you could kill somebody? I was like, where? She said, in a woman's gym in a hotel. She said, because I was working out alone, and there was no one else around. I thought, I'd done it already, honey. I killed somebody in the Westin Hotel, the women's locker room. So it was called, in Left 4 Dead, the killer's name was Rembrandt. I won't even go, it would be too creepy for me to tell you what Rembrandt, somebody, you read the book, right? Yeah, you know, okay, Rembrandt's pretty creepy. Anyway, let's talk about Madison Park Beach in The Last Victim. I had a couple of skinny dippers there who were like in college, and in fact, I have a couple of skinny dippers. Let's go right to the Arboretum in Disturbed, too. I have a theme going on with skinny dippers discovering dead bodies. And so that's a twofer. We got the Volunteer Park, we got the Arboretum, and we got Madison Park Beach skinny dippers. And you can always tell which way my bread is buttered, because it's like somebody was telling me, you know, there's these long descriptions of the guys. They like his sinewy body in the moonlight. And the girl was naked, too. Anyway. And by the way, P.S., footnote. Anyway, so those are two places. We got the Bremerton Ferry in Killing Spree. I forgot Killing Spree was one of those ones that just, you know, it was one of those unique titles that had no connection to any other book. Anyway, a man in a red Ford Probe drives it off the back of the Bremerton Ferry, and he goes, and I had a red Ford Probe, and every book has somebody in a red Ford Probe, because maybe I'd like the sound of it. Who knows? Let's not even go there, okay? Anyway. We're talking number 6 is the Harvard exit in Final Breath. This was one of my favorites. The woman was using her cell phone all through the movie. And she goes up to the restroom, and somebody yells at her for using their cell phone in the restroom. Don't even get me started on cell phones in the bathroom. Somebody was using a cell phone at the urinal on my way back from one of the airports. And then he put the cell phone down on top of the urinal to, like, finish up. I was like, oh, you're going to put that against your... Am I digressing? Yes, I guess. Anyway, so just a tiny bit. Do I have 1 minute? 1 minute, says Jenny. Okay, so she goes up to and she's using the phone in the restroom. She goes in the stall and somebody grabs her from under her legs in the stall. So I have a friend who says he cannot go to the Harvard exit and use the restroom. So I was like, well, it was the women's room. What the hell are you doing in there? Anyway, the final one is... did I mention Vicious? No, Vicious, a volunteer park. A woman is hauled into the bushes, jogging by. Yeah, I know. My neighbor was so pissed off for me. I get this banging on my door one day, and she's like, I'm reading your book. I jog right there by the greenhouse. Now I can't go there anymore because you've done this to me. Anyway. So I'm wrapping up work on my new book. Like I say, No One Needs to Know. And in that one, this is my bonus one because I think I've done 7. I'm killing somebody, I'm throwing her down, and she's kind of a nasty gossip anyway, so she's got it coming. That was a definite 7 minutes, isn't it? Okay. Well, I'm going to just tell you this one real quick. It's only going to last about 20 minutes. I threw a lady down, the Blaine Street stairs, you know, that go, what, 360 steps? Crunch, crunch, crunch. Anyway, let's see. Speaking of stairs, let's see if I make it down here. Thank you so much.
Kevin is a scream, isn't he? You must read his books and you will scream. Next up, we have Rebecca Wells. Rebecca studied theater, English, and psychology at Louisiana State University, Tibetan Buddhism at Naropa Institute in Boulder, Colorado, jazz piano in Paris, and acting in New York. She's now a playwright and a novelist, and her published books include The Crowning Glory of Calla Lily Ponder and The Divine Secrets of the Yaya Sisterhood, which was a finalist for the Orange Prize, just so you know, and one of those books that transcended the stratosphere in popularity. We are so happy to have her here with us tonight. Rebecca.
Well, I'm writing material that's not exactly Yaya material right now. This is from my war diary. Friday, 9:15 p.m. Tonight I heard a third-rate reporter with a name like Boutros Ghali criticize our Raytheon Tomahawk guided missile. It is hard to believe that some people don't even know what Raytheon is. How could they not know what Raytheon is? Raytheon, who gave us Agent Orange to help us win the Vietnam War? That Agent Orange could flat out defoliate a country. Some people ignore history. Boutros Ghali. I just think of those words one time and I can't get them out of my head. Boutros Ghali, Boutros Ghali, Boutros Ghali. I have an Elmer's glue kind of brain. Saturday, 9:22. Raytheon is the largest producer of guided missiles in the world, and they invented microwaves, making life for women a whole lot easier. Boutros Ghali, Boutros Ghali, Boutros Ghali. Sunday, 11:17 a.m. I have faced the nation and met the press, and I say thank God for Raytheon. They have agreed to give us twice the number of Tomahawks than we first asked for. Raytheon didn't let us down. They didn't walk out of the room calling us a domestic terrorist like my husband did. Boutros Ghali. Boutros Ghali. Boutros Ghali. Sunday, 7:28 p.m. The Tomahawk is small, and it doesn't need a pilot. It can circle high above the ground for 1,000 miles and drop a 1,000-pound high-explosive bomb on a target the size of a one-car garage. Sunday, 7:30, 4 p.m. I'm getting on the internet. Boutros, Boutros, Ghali. Sunday, 11:03 p.m. I can't believe 3.5 hours went by and I didn't say Boutros, Boutros, Ghali. The Tomahawk missile is exactly what Raytheon's website says it is. Modern, mature, and powerful. It's there in bold black letters. Don't we all wish that we could say that about ourselves? I think Raytheon can read minds. Monday, 5:34 p.m. Migraine Public Radio announced that some Syrian villagers were killed when they got in the way of one of our Raytheon Tomahawks. I am sincerely sorry about that. I am also sorry for the past few years we have used up a lot of money and a lot of American warriors to give people democracy. Then they didn't even have the sense to know what to do with it. They turn on each other and we have to go back there and clean up their mess. Again. Monday night, 9 o'clock sharp. Accidents happen. Tuesday, 7:16 p.m. What's his name? The head of the House of Armed Services said, Tomahawks give us unmanned, all-weather, deep strike attack capability against both fixed and mobile targets. Tomahawks transcend nations and borders. Wednesday, 1:24 a.m. They're saying there was a boy. Wednesday, 8:12 p.m. Anderson Cooper says a Raytheon Tomahawk costs $1.4 million. At first I thought, that is a lot of money to deliver a small package. Then I thought, someone has got to stop those killers. Thursday, 1:34 a.m. There's a whole story now. They say the boy's name is Luco, age 5. Thursday, 7:03 p.m., Dateline NBC. The Raytheon Tomahawk gives us capabilities in the areas of sensing, effects, command, and control. But nothing is perfect. Friday, 2:46 in the morning. He was supposed to be in a neighboring village visiting his grandmother, they say. Friday, 8:22 p.m. Fox News, Fox News, Fox News, Boutros, 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 Ghali, Fox. Boutros. The Tomahawk can circle for hours, shift course instantly, and beam a picture of its target on the controllers halfway around the world before it strikes with pinpoint accuracy. That's something I would love to do. Circle around my life, shift courses instantly. Saturday morning, 1:07 a.m. I think I saw Luco in the edge of the picture. Skinny legs, sandals. Saturday, 2:35 a.m. I understand why the Tomahawk flies so high above the ground. United States warriors shouldn't see stuff like this. Neither should we. Could interfere with their job performance. Sunday morning, 2 a.m. sharp. Crazy stuff happening to me in my sleep, in my bed where I sleep alone, all unguided. I try to fly, but I can't. No American boots on the ground. I just keep seeing small, empty sandals. On them is dust and the stain of red. They are not modern or mature, no power. Just a pair of little boys' sandals. It's Friday night again already. 8:15. Headache. Turned off CNN early. I've been having the same dream for the past week. Luca, part toddler, part little boy. His skin the color of tea. His hands smell like lemon and garlic. He's running with a bunch of kids, playing hide and go seek. The air is dry. The sun is hot. Eeny, meeny, miny, mo. Catch a tiger by his toe. If he hollers, make him pay $50 every day. My mother told me to pick the very best one, and you are it. Luco is running toward base. Ready or not, here I come. Ali, ali, oxen free. Over and over. Luco keeps running for base. I see him running. He's almost free when poof, he disappears. Poof, Luco, you disappear. Mobile target, smaller than a one-car garage. Pomegranate juice in the dust. Boutros, Boutros, Ghali, oxy, oxy, ali, free. Boutros, Boutros, transcend all countries and borders. Transcend all countries and borders. Transcend. Transcend.
Very powerful. Next up, we have Frances McHugh, who is no stranger to Hugo House. She's the founder of Hugo House, and she served 10 years as its director and is an award-winning author and poet. Her latest book is called Mary Randlett Portraits. Yeah? Did I get it right?
Yeah.
I can't see a thing over there. Her book of poetry, Bled, won the 2011 Washington State Book Award. She was also a finalist in the nonfiction category that year with a book titled The Car That Brought You Here Still Runs, Revisiting the Northwest Towns of Richard Hugo. And as many of you know, she's a generous spirit in the Seattle community and a very fun gal. Please welcome Frances McHugh.
Thanks, everybody. So this Mary Randlett Portraits book is, it's a little bit of Seattle history, and it includes visual artists and writers to accompany portraits taken by the photographer Mary Randlett. One of the people whom she photographed quite a bit was Tom Robbins. You all know who Tom Robbins? Still Life with a Woodpecker, Even Cowgirls Get the Blues. And this is a little piece I wrote about having to chaperone Tom Robbins. And it's coming out in the new Sasquatch anthology edited by Ryan Boudinot about literary places in Seattle. Chaperoning Tom Robbins. My job was to meet Tom Robbins in the alley behind Tower Records along University Way in Seattle. This was in 1987, or maybe it was early in 1988. Why the alley? I asked. Why not the lobby of the bookstore across the street or something? That's what he wants, Colleen McElroy said. She looked fiercely at me. Back then, the MFA program at the University of Washington was newly formed. It used to be an MA degree, and Colleen had been the one to get the F inserted in it. And Colleen was a well-known poet and the program's director, and she was just nobody to mess with. She was also the faculty advisor for this reading series, and I was a young student, and we Watermark people, the Watermark reading series, had decided to invite Tom Robbins to give a reading on campus. So I bring him over there from Tower Records to Kane Hall. Colleen looked at me. Yes, and you be sure he isn't late. She lowered her eyebrows. Colleen bossed me around, partly because I was the youngest person in the MFA program. I had a skateboard, and I went around twirling the wheels all the time. And partly because I have an instinct to both rebel and attach, I took to her. I was a girl with a mouth and some smarts, and what smarts I didn't have, I used my mouth to make up for. I was pretty ambitious. I wanted to get this whole literary business right. Later, I figured out that Colleen had some of the same traits. She'd been an only child from her mother's first failed marriage, and she'd also been a bookish, mouthy kid who got out of the place where she began and headed west. So, on the appointed night, I walked over to 43rd, one of the side streets off of University Way. I headed up behind the Big Tower Records. Big Five Sports is there now. The alley was filthier then, crowded with dumpsters and metal trash cans. It was early evening and the day's refuse had steamed and settled. The place stunk. I came along the trench, a broken pavement, and when I looked up, I saw a little man between two big guys. They all looked down the alley at me. That's the first thing about Tom Robbins. He's smaller than you think he's going to be. He has this impish, crooked grin and some prickly blonde hair, and he's light and small, but the other guys weren't. They were big, thick guys. "Hey," Tom said. "Hi," I said. "This is Bob," Tom said. He pointed to the man who had a little beard scruff. "And this is Bob," he said, pointing to the other one. "Hi." I was staring at the three of them. Tom in the middle, with these guys bookending him. I nodded to the two men. "You guys are both named Bob?" "Yes, they are," said Tom Robbins. "I'm Tom, and these are Bob's." "Oh, hi." I reached out and shook Tom's hand. The Bobs flinched a little. One leaned in over our handshake. "These are my bodyguards," Tom said, flicking his thumbs in either direction. Remember the thumbs in the... Okay. The Bobs had bulges on the chests of their overcoats. "Guns? Do they have guns?" "Of course they have guns," Tom Robbins said. "Listen, I was down at Berkeley and some woman threw a bottle at me right out of the audience. It was crazy." Maybe it was jitterbug perfume or even cowgirls get the blues that had ticked them off. Whatever it was, things didn't go over that well at Berkeley. This was confusing for me. Tom Robbins, the radical novelist whom the radical feminists didn't like. Back then, I thought radical was radical. I didn't know that different parts of radical might not like each other. "Okay," I said. "Well, what did I know? I had a lot to learn. I was maybe 24 years old, and I didn't have the slightest idea about how cool Tom Robbins was, or how famous, or what was necessary for a writer of that stature. Bodyguards? Okay, then." I walked with Tom and his Bobs over to the Rethke, the Rethke Auditorium at Kane Hall. Amazing. I think of it now, how many world-class writers have read in that space. Adrienne Rich, Elizabeth Bishop, Nobel laureates, you name it. It's one of Seattle's long-lasting literary crossroads, and it's right on Red Square in a bunker-like structure next to the Exhale Tower from the parking garage. I once watched Raymond Carver and Tess Gallagher make their way up the aisles in that space, Tess flicking back her hair and Ray in a long overcoat, looking for a seat for some reading I can't remember. When Tom and the Bobs came into Kane Hall, we went to the room behind the auditorium. I said, "So, I saved some seats for Bob and Bob." "No," Tom said. "Bob and Bob will be on stage with me." "But I have seats for them right in the front row." Tom turned to me and snapped. "How the f*** will they shoot anybody if they're sitting in the front row?" I didn't have an answer. This was before Public Enemy taught us all about having an aggressive presence on stage. "Oh, wow," I said, "oh." I think I went to Colleen and told her what was going on, and I can't remember whether she asked the Bobs to take a seat or what, but the audience was full. Tom read his wild work, and people cheered, and nobody threw a bottle, and the Bobs didn't have to open fire. Nobody got hurt. Afterwards, we went to China Harbor, that big black glassed-in, impossible-to-see-inside restaurant on Lake Union where I sat next to Tom's wife, Alexa, who turned out to be an astrologer. When I met her, I realized people can really be astrologers. The world then seemed so full of possibility. Thank you.
And you always wondered what it was like to hang out with Tom Robbins, right? Finally, and not least at all, number 7 is Mr. Jamie Ford, who came all the way from Montana to be with us tonight. Jamie, as you no doubt know, won the highly acclaimed and best-selling, highly acclaimed and best-selling novel Hotel at the Corner of Bitter and Sweet. His latest book is The Songs of Willow Frost. He's also published in Secret Identities, the Asian American Superhero Anthology, and The End is Nigh, Part of the Apocalypse Triptych, a series of 3 anthologies of apocalyptic and post-apocalyptic fiction. He likes the post-apocalypse, I guess. But perhaps his biggest accomplishment is being the father of 4 freaking teenagers, even though he looks like he's about 28. Our grand finale tonight, Mr. Jamie Ford.
Wow. I love this dark room. This is like a basement Warren where we plot a Bolshevik revolution. Vote Strelnikov. That's for you Dr. Zhivago fans. Okay. I'm going to read just 3 pages, since we're close to Halloween, 3 pages of a ghost story that I wrote just last week for Humanities Washington. And if you like it, it's out there on the interwebs. And it's a true ghost story, which is interesting. I know it's true because my Ouija board told me it was true. So this is Wish You Were Here at the Bottom of a Well. December 1911. F. Lewis Clark had been married to his beautiful wife, Winifred, a Parisian-schooled socialite and a concert pianist of some renown, for 18 years, and in that time, she'd never once been faithful. You see, Winifred was an artist whose favorable medium was infidelity, whose canvases were the finest sateen sheets as she dabbled in exotic oils and silk and sweat. Though to be somewhat fair, F. Lewis was no perfect man either, no candidate for sainthood. By 1911, he was a Maine-born, Harvard-schooled multimillionaire amassing a vast fortune in timber, mining, and real estate. And he'd had his own moments of weakness, but to his credit, he'd never purposely gone out of his way to hurt anyone, not the way Winifred did when she looked at him knowingly and blew him a kiss before taking the arm of Horace Ketchum, F. Lewis's longtime business partner and the best man at his wedding. She smiled as she led him upstairs to one of the many guest bedrooms of the Spokane Club. F. Lewis had long known of the affair, but he knew with a clarity now that pierced his heart. He watched them brazenly ascend the staircase, his world frozen. He was a prisoner with a noose around his neck, standing on the gallows, waiting for the trapdoor. He was the child whose kitten had gone missing near the railroad tracks. He was the expectant mother watching a doctor fumble with a stethoscope, knowing the next words will be, "There is no heartbeat." And so it was with a broken heart that F. Lewis invited his wife to the basement of the Spokane Club the next evening. "I want you to see the wine cellar," he said. "I need your help picking out a bottle, something special I can celebrate with." "You can't do anything by yourself, can you, Lewis?" she groaned. "What's the occasion? Horace says business is failing your half anyways." "It's a special celebration," he mumbled, as he led her through the dusty cellar and beyond a small creaking door into a dark room that had been locked for as long as F. Lewis could remember. "You won't believe what's in here." "Really?" Winifred said, yawning. She'd been up quite late the night before. "And what are we celebrating, dear husband?" F. Lewis waited a moment until her eyes could adjust to the darkness, until he knew she could see what his eyes were searching for, a deep pit in the middle of the room. But F. Lewis knew that the real pit, the true yawning abyss, had been found in his own chest when he had walked into the master suite of Honeysuckle Lodge, his palatial estate on Hayden Lake. His arms had been filled with red roses, but Winifred was also in bloom, and her arms were filled with Horace, as he made love to her atop the grand piano F. Lewis had given her for her first wedding anniversary. The Steinway was sturdy, and the piano didn't wobble or budge as Winifred's feet and Horace's knees banged out random notes, rhythmic flats and sharps, while a metronome ticked back and forth like a wagging finger. "Lewis," Winifred needled, "I asked you a question." F. Lewis turned to his wife in the darkness, held her arms gently, touched her lips to his, even as she turned away, And then he whispered, "I'm celebrating our divorce." He didn't push Winifred as much as he let her go. At least that's what he told himself as he watched her corseted body tip backward, bending, falling slowly like a freshly hewn Douglas fir. He studied her shocked, wide-eyed expression as she tumbled, her dress, scarlet lace, and white petticoats swallowed whole by the darkness. Effluous licked his lips, tasting her final reluctant kiss as he wiped a single tear. He winced as her screams were interrupted as she bounced against the walls of the old well he'd kept hidden in the basement of the gentleman's club that he helped build. Effluous closed his eyes, and his heart raced as he listened in vain for a splash or a crash, but her body trailed off seemingly to infinity. Without an impact, she wasn't dead in his mind. She was merely gone, because no one knew how deep this ancient well was. Before construction on the club began, engineers, oilmen experienced in drilling 2,000-foot boreholes had given up when their means of measurement played out at 6,000 feet. And no one knew who did the masonry or when, but superstitious locals had boarded up the hole ages ago and marked it with a sign that read Porta Infernus. F. Lewis nodded and sighed. He didn't believe in the gates of hell. He'd been married to Winifred for 18 years. The rest of the story is out there, and I think it's for sale, and the proceeds all go to Humanities Washington. And Humanities Washington, they promote literacy and cure erectile dysfunction. They do all kinds of crazy things. So thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Let's have a hand for all of our wonderful writers. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this Lit Crawl Seattle 2014 podcast from Speakers Forum on KUOW 94.9. If you appreciate the series, please give us a good review. It helps more people find us. Lit Crawl Seattle is a volunteer organization. Readers, hosts, venues, and sponsors donate time, goods, and services to make it possible. This year's sponsors included the Elliott Bay Book Company, Georgetown Brewing Company, Hugo House, Shunpike, Four Culture, and DCG1. The third annual Lit Crawl Seattle took place on October 23rd, 2014, at venues around Capitol Hill. Thanks again to Michelle Goodman and Anna Tatashev for these recordings. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.